The people who make independent magazines aren't motivated by fame or fortune. They simply want their passion projects to reach an appreciative community of like-minded readers. Still, given the long hours and unpredictable financial returns, most wouldn't turn down an offer of an open bar, and maybe even a gong or two. On today's programme, a look back at last week's Stack Awards, plus a magazine that never fails to have us dusting off our tennis whites, and another to take you off the beaten track. All that ahead today on The Stack. From Midori House in London, this is The Stack, 30 minutes of print industry analysis. Now, many industry award ceremonies are a drag, clinical, predictable, mainly attended out of a sense of grim obligation. The Stack Awards, which seek to acknowledge the best in indie magazine publishing, are the opposite. Convivial, impassioned. The third annual iteration was held last Monday at the Queen of Hoxton pub in East London. I was there with this programme's producer, Henry Rees-Sheridan, who joins me now to look back. And Henry, let's start by reminding our listeners, they've probably heard from Stack Magazine's Steve Watson, a regular guest, of course, within these four walls. They distribute some of the very best in independent print from around the world, and they bring a lot of that, the best of the year, together for their awards. Your first time attending?
It was my first time attending. I have to say, I was really impressed, particularly by the atmosphere there. You did get a sense that, you know, I think the world of indie magazine publishing is, in some ways, tightly knit. There's a relatively small number of people who are involved in it. They tend to read and appreciate each other's work. They're obviously tightly connected through online communication a lot of the time. But I don't think they get too many opportunities to come together in one room.
And a bit of revelry. Merriment.
A little bit of revelry and merriment, indeed. And also, you know, putting faces to names, putting faces to titles as well, always kind of helps bring the personalities behind the work alive. And I think a lot of people seem to be enjoying that.
Well, no, and I should say, of course, one of the really great things I think about the Stack Awards is that it reflected so many of the themes that our guests talk about on this programme. And that was why it was great to see old friends and new ones too. We had, and we'll talk a bit more about some of the winners, but we had recognition and awards for the likes of I Magazine, one of my favourites. We've had the editors on this programme, bumped into the Dog Magazine team. And wherever you turn, there were friendly faces, and there was so much of a shared narrative about why print is so exciting, the growth. And Jeremy Leslie, another long-term collaborator of ours, was there, and he was talking in one of his speeches about it's not just that print is doing fine and the reports of the death of print are exaggerated. It was that it's booming. You know, so many titles, you know, in terms of launch of the year, there was almost literally dozens to choose from, each with a compelling narrative. Brilliant editors, many of them young. Student Magazine of the Year is another category where you just delighted at how many brilliant, at, you know, the next generation of editors who are out there.
This is the thing, and I think for an award ceremony too, it didn't feel very competitive. And I think that's because there's an acknowledgement within the industry that a rising tide raises all boats. You know, I think within indie magazine publishing,
nautical,
that really, it's a platitude which is rolled out in a lot of different contexts, but I think it really rings true in this particular industry. You know, financial rewards are hard to come by at the best of times. And I think an increase in the general awareness of this type of work, the kind of people who are likely to buy one title really are, I think, likely to branch out and explore much more of titles that have a similar aesthetic and worldview.
Henry, let's mention a couple of the specifics, of course. I was one of the judges alongside another friend of ours, Christoph Armand, of course, from Zeit Magazine, of the Editor of the Year category. And the brilliant winners were MacGuffin Magazine, which featured, of course, in the award ceremony last year. Kirsten and Ernst out of Amsterdam. Just simply so good in every department. I mean, it's impossible to ignore. Its merits shine off every page.
Well, I think it's worth mentioning that MacGuffin won two different awards this year. So they won Editor of the Year, which you judge. They also got Art Director of the Year award. And I'm interested in hearing from you. You know, you obviously judge one of those awards. I'm sure you appreciate why it won the other category too. Mm. What makes it so good? What makes it stand out?
I think it's about editors and a whole editorial team who are right at the top of their game. And I think what was interesting, we reflected on this during the ceremony as well, to get recognised is hard enough, but to win awards, to be lauded by your peers, you have to be so consistent. And if you're setting your stall out the way McGuffin does, to take one theme, often something very specific, where people will bring a lot of expectation to their purchase of the magazine or browsing on a newsstand, and to turn that on its head, to challenge that, to entertain, to show mastery of your materials, page after page after page. It's just such an enterprise, and I think anyone who's edited anything knows how difficult that is.
Consistency and within issues you're talking about.
And just
about.
Consistency and like singularity of vision and creative purpose is so hard. And that was demonstrated not just by McGuffin but by others. And we should say, of course, Magazine of the Year went to Buffalo Zine.
Which I actually hadn't heard of, I have to say, before that night. And I've done a bit of research since. And it is an absolutely fascinating proposition. I think both as a print object, I think they offer several different iterations of each issue. But not only that, between issues, well, they radically alter the format.
So they say, right, this is going to be our take on, you know, a more traditional fashion magazine, I guess. But then they'll be, as a sort of almost like a newspaper, they'll become a zine. And they're having this extraordinary metamorphosis. And again, the risk there, you would say, well, where's the consistency of tone? You know, how do you even feel like you're reading the same thing? But to deliver that consistency whilst having this extraordinary metamorphic approach, I mean, just excellent.
It beggars belief, doesn't it? The application. And also, I think for a fashion magazine, I mean, fashion magazines lead the way in a lot of different fields, you know, visuals, advertising, not best known for their sense of humour, I think it's fair to say. And Buffalo certainly injects a healthy dose of that.
Yeah, and the guys were hilarious, accepting their award as well. A couple of others we should mention. Another two-time winner, Anxi Magazine, which is out of Berkeley. And yet we should say the sort of European arm, if you like, is looked after out of Berlin by Katty, who's actually a Monocle contributor and a friend of ours as well. So that was brilliant to see them win not just Launch of the Year, but also
Subscriber's Choice as well, which obviously is a popular vote.
Ticking off the popular vote as well. And some other favourites. As I mentioned earlier, they won Cover of the Year. They had essentially this run of unique covers, i.e. every mag.
And it wasn't a particularly short print run either, was it?
I think it was a good
2000 or something.
Just absolutely brilliant. And that's what it's about, pushing the envelope and being still innovative and surprising and managing to deliver time after time. So much to enjoy. Others of my favourites, which were either mentioned in dispatches or featured, we had Ruleur winning, Racket, our good friend David, who I think we might be hearing a bit more from.
I think we might, yeah.
Also recognised. So, yeah, it was a really terrific day, and we should say thanks to all of our friends, old and new ones we made, who were there, and in particular, of course, to Steve and his team, who put on a pretty good event. It was an evening to celebrate, wasn't it, Henry?
I think so.
You had one too many.
Well, it was an open bar. I didn't have one too many. I felt a bit ill, actually, that night.
That is what happens after, Henry. Now, let's move on. A thread connecting many of the mags featured in the Stack Awards is that they used a particular theme as a lens through which to look at much broader topics. I just mentioned David from Racket. And Racket is a magazine which, on the face of it, is about tennis. But open up the latest, you'll find essays about Russian literature, photographic topography of homemade handball balls, and, of course, an artistic interpretation of historic tennis socks. Henry, the kind of thing you would pore over. David, when he was over in London, David Shaftel, the editor, joined me in the studio to talk a bit more about what they've been up to.
Well, the presses have been pressed, so we'll have our fifth edition in about a week or two, and we kind of wanted to get it ready with plenty of time to get it to Australia for the Australian Open in January without having to pay. You know, we wanted to put it on the boat rather than the plane. But yeah, we're still having a blast, and I think they're still getting better, which is a mixed blessing, which means there's things in the earlier issues that I wish I could go back and fix. But I feel like we're raising the level still, which is very satisfying.
And it's interesting because I guess, obviously, Racket kind of reflects the seasonality of the game. And it's interesting the way that it follows around. And we've talked before about the colour schemes reflect the majors and this sort of thing. As you kind of start to, I guess, repeat the cycles almost, I mean, that's exciting, isn't it? I guess it provides new opportunities, but maybe fresh challenges in some ways as well.
Well, figuring out the schedule for us has been a bit of a learning curve. We rushed the first one out for the U.S. Open last year. And we have this big splash, new tennis magazine, U.S. Open. Got it from the printer the Friday before the tournament. And it's wonderful. We had it, but then the tournament's over in 2 weeks.
now what do we do?
So that was the nature of our launch. You know, that wasn't, it was what it was. So then we were sort of looking at the schedule and we let the U.S. Open one live for a good 5 or 6 weeks before the U.S. Open and gain some momentum. Same with the Wimbledon one. And they're not really specifically pegged to those tournaments. We want to have new material out when people are thinking about tennis. Hmm. But we do have a lot of options. It doesn't have to be Wimbledon and grass in June. The French Open is 3 weeks before that. We could be talking about Europe and clay and Monte Carlo and Argentina, or Wimbledon and Queen's Club in Birmingham. I think the key is just to have them ready when people are ready to start thinking about tennis and watching tennis. But to your question about having the covers reflect the season. So last year we had this bright pink cover with a map on it that we hoped to telegraph to people that tennis, you know, when it's cold here in London or New York where we're based, there's tennis being played on the warm side of the earth. This year we went with it's a heavily filtered photograph of an indoor tennis court in Copenhagen from 1912 of a Danish tennis player in Copenhagen's first indoor tennis court, which is just a picture we thought was really great, and we give it a yellow filter and we love the treatment of it. But to us it's very autumnal. It speaks to indoor tennis, the time of year when if you're like us, you're playing indoors. That's what we were thinking with this one, because last year, you know, we talked about Asia and all these exotic locations. So we wanted to do something autumnal that felt a bit cozy for the season. But of course, we do have stories in the magazine sort of pegged to what's going on in tennis. So we have a story about the Australian ethos of tennis. We have a story about a tennis court in Japan, you know, going through Asia in January, February. So we're thinking about all these things, but we try not to get too hemmed in by them.
Now, we're lucky. You've got a few different, I guess, what are these kind of sneak peeks, little excerpts, things that you can talk to us about. Do you want to talk us through a couple? I mean, I don't want you to give away any trade secrets too early, David, you understand? But maybe mention a couple of the particular little standouts here.
Sure. Well, the only trade secret I could give away here is that I printed these on my laser jet at home.
These are all trade secrets. That's fine. There's value there.
You know, going into our fifth issue, we're sort of figuring out what we do best and what people like best and what we can do that's different. And because we're quarterly, it's very difficult for us to do timely stories, results-based stories. So we're sort of honing in on what we do best, I think. And two of the things that I'm most excited about in this issue are we have a story about tennis scents and tennis perfumes and perfumers that have thought about tennis by a really accomplished perfume writer called Rachel Simon. She's actually an accomplished writer, full stop, but she also happens to be a published perfume newsletter. And she's written this story about scent and memory and what perfumers think about when they're making a perfume. So in this case, there are a few tennis perfumes out there. And, you know, her point is that you want it to smell like an imagined or romanticized game.
Yeah, not the actual locker room.
Sweat in the locker room. And she, you know, she talks about her own memories of tennis growing up. She didn't play, like most of our writers. This was another case of, you know, writer's interested but knows nothing about tennis. So is a bit skeptical, and that's music to our ears. But her dad and brother played, and her grandparents would make tuna fish sandwiches for them. So that's what tennis smells like to her, is tuna sandwiches. So that's the jumping off point. But there's a lot of really smart stuff about perfume and how it's made. In the story, it is also revealed that there's a sort of low-end perfume called Fuzzy Balls, I think, that actually smells like tennis balls, because everybody loves
the new can.
Yeah, it's exactly.
That's very evocative. Well, and they say, of course, that smell is the most isn't it supposed to be the most potently stimulating of all kind of memories, even more than things that you remember by sight or by sound?
Yeah.
As I understand from
so, reading and editing this story as well.
That's good. No, that's great fun. And what about something else? You got a kind of a picture. Talk about this. What do you got, some photos?
Okay, so
well?
This is a case where we thought we could be timely. We're learning that we've got a tricky relationship with nostalgia because there's so many great old stories of tennis, sort of undertold stories, great images. We're looking at here is images from the first pro tennis tournament after the amateur era. So Wimbledon and all the Grand Slams were restricted to amateurs until 1968, and anyone who was a pro, like Rod Laver, for example, wasn't allowed to play. So you had these two different tiers, and 68, they came to their senses and said, everybody can play, because the amateurs were being paid under the table or paid appearance fees. So the very first tournament where pros and amateurs could all play, tennis became fully professional, was at the West Hants Tennis Club in Bournemouth 50 years ago. But that was, I believe, in April, and a really accomplished British tennis journalist called Simon Cambers, who writes for The Telegraph, wrote it for us, interviewed all these great players, Rod Laver, Virginia Wade, who won it. So this is sort of our nod to an anniversary and something we can actually peg a story to.
It's funny about that sort of time capsule quality. And I don't know why tennis does seem to be particularly evocative. I don't know, why is it? Even maybe more than some other sports in terms of that nostalgia that you describe. I don't know why that is, really, but it definitely has it. Is it, I don't, is it the outfits or because it has that seasonality? I don't know. There's something about it as a sport.
This is, our mission is to figure this out. So I don't know is the short answer, but there was, I mean, the outfits are great. The '60s and seventies is before the big athletic wear companies came in. So in this picture of Virginia Wade that I'm looking at, she's wearing a dress made by a clothing designer called Ted Tinling, who made all of the women's clothes from really the '50s to the early '80s. And Virginia Wade, for example, would go to him and say, I need some dresses for the season. So, I mean, she's wearing a cardigan sweater here. It's a bit deceptive because it looks like a bright, sunny day. But as we learn in the story, it was freezing. And
Of course, yeah.
A British player, Mark Cox, who was an amateur who was supposed to get slaughtered by everyone, went really deep into the tournament because he was local and could play on the weird shale court, and his hands didn't go numb. Laver, I think, talks about his hands going numb at the tournament. But yeah, Wade, she was played and possibly won this tournament wearing a cardigan sweater. Also, back to your point about why it's so evocative, there was this great tennis boom in the 70s and 80s where it became, at least in America, really, really fashionable. It was in movies, everybody was playing, there were lines at the courts. So a lot of us who are my age, I'm 43, this is right in the wheelhouse of our youth. You know, my mother played, and I can't imagine now what that must have looked like, with all due respect to my mother. But as far as the, you know, nostalgia thing goes, we really try to use color photographs when we can of that era because, well, first of all, they look so great, just the saturation and the sort of grainy feel to them. But we have this complicated relationship with nostalgia because we really want to traffic in it, and there's these great images and these great stories, but we don't want to be seen as an exercise in nostalgia. We want to be...
Yeah, forward-looking. Contemporary and innovative, exactly. Yeah. Well, to that point about innovation, it's interesting. Often when we talk to different independent magazines, and you quite quickly see, especially if they've done well and they gain some traction, that the sort of traditional magazine market in their space starts to kind of take notice. You know, I've seen it with a lot of, I always follow a lot of titles that follow football, soccer, or whatever. And you start to see that independent, some of those independent kind of motifs getting into the sort of more glossy end of the spectrum. Do you already see that in the tennis publication? Because there's lots of razzle dazzle kind of tennis magazines that are very, we're going to sell you loads of kit and here's what the big names are doing. Do you already see some of your kind of more considered approach bleeding in around the edges?
Well, no. I mean, we don't really have any tennis magazines in America. There's Tennis Magazine, which is gear, tips, that kind of thing. But no, it's very glossy and quite thin these days, if I'm frank. But to your point, Esquire in the U.S. has gone back to the old masthead and a very nostalgic-looking cover with Bryan Cranston. And if I'm not mistaken, the masthead has gone back here as well, which I thought was an interesting play for them. I mean, I love the Cranston cover, for example. But I just think it's tricky with nostalgia, because at what point, especially for a very established magazine, do you say, all right, let's traffic in our past now because the present isn't working out? I'm not accusing Esquire of that, but...
No, but it's, you're right. It's, that's a delicate kind of line, isn't it, to strike?
To do it once, you know, you see it and you're like, oh my God, this is so cool. I remember used to look like this. The classic cover is Muhammad Ali. And then, I don't know, I feel like it's dangerous, but... you know, nobody's asked my opinion.
Well, I did, David. That's what we were doing. It's a very exciting time. So this iteration of Wreck-It is out when exactly? Or was it,
we roll imminently. It's out when it's ready, but about a week, 2 weeks, I'd say, so, we'll have them in.
So keep a weather eye wherever you happen to be. David, it's a delight to welcome you, as always. I hope you enjoy the rest of the end of season bonanza here in London town and all the rest, and more power to you. Come and see us when the next one's out as well.
Always, yeah, it's a pleasure.
That was David Shaftel, editor of Wreck-It magazine. Issue 4 is out now, or imminently. You're listening to The Stack on Monocle 24. Cartography calls itself a travel magazine, but it doesn't subscribe to many of that genre's conventions. Each destination in the magazine comes with a photographic album, a short text, a map, and an itinerary. But the camera's gaze is more anthropological than promotional, capturing lulls in the lives of local residents and overlooked corners of the natural and built environment. The prose, in English and Italian, has a similar flavour, more meditative than splashy. Gianluigi Ricuperati, a contributing writer to the publication, recently joined Monocle's Fernando Augusto Pacheco in the studio to tell him more about it.
It's a magazine devoted to travel culture, from documentary photography to anthropology, food culture, abstract still life, stories. The concept behind the title is that every journey hides a world. So it's a world within a world. If maps shape our idea of the world and the place we live in, cartography is aiming at encouraging every single person, every single reader, to embark on a journey in space and time to better understand the world. There are incredibly interesting pictures, but at the same time, the role of storytelling, the role of written word, and I would also say the role of the typographic experimentation is very crucial in cartography.
That sounds like a beautiful definition, Gianluigi. I would like to also ask, what's your connection with the title? I've been working with them since the first issue.
I cannot say that I'm part of the founding team, because it would be not fair, but I can say that I'm a supporter. I'm part of the first role of supporter, and I'm also a very happy contributor with them. We've been doing incredibly good collaboration for what the collaboration between text and image is concerned. So they are very, very well balanced in terms of respecting both media, both ways. And I would also say that it's a cross-disciplinary magazine.
And I love the destinations the magazine goes, because, you know, they're certainly offbeat. So it's different from some other travel magazines. For example, on issue 2, I believe you went to the Peruvian Amazon. The new one is Tahiti, Pantelleria, Sardinia. Tell us, how do you know what's the process of choosing which destinations will be covered?
Luca and Paola are choosing the destination in out of their curiosity. So I think that cartography is a sort of print university of curiosity and a guide to curiosity through travel. That's what I think is their attitude. So they sometimes are interested in bizarre destination, like in the next issue there will be something about Dakota and South Dakota animals. In the current issue, there's an incredibly beautiful set of photographies regarding a trip. I had the pleasure of being with them in this trip. It's a trip to Pantelleria, which is one of the most impressive islands in the Mediterranean. And in this case, it's an interesting collaboration also between a brand and a totally independent choice of subject, because Pantelleria project has been done in collaboration with Armani, and it's started as an exploration of the beautiful place that Giorgio Armani lived in Pantelleria and is one of his most beloved and well-kept secrets. It's very difficult that he opens up the doors of this place to media or journalists. And Giorgio Armani decided to open up his villa, and I was really honored to be part of this trip because we were alone in Giorgio Armani's place for like some days, and it was really an otherworldly situation in which we experienced a kind of very, very discreet luxury with the savage beauty and the almost outrageous beauty of what I would call the faculty of Mediterranean disciplines.
Oh, you've sold it, Pantelleria, for me, I have to say, Gianluigi. Another thing that I would like to ask, even though, of course, the magazine has an Italian DNA, it feels very international. Even the text is, you know, in both languages. So was that the intention since the beginning to make a proper international magazine?
It feels a global enterprise, but with a very excruciatingly important local attitude. Local in the sense, but this local attitude changes every pages because every issue has three or four or five destinations. So it's a globe-trotting torn out not by anxiety of discovery, but of the calm and stillness that is necessary to go in depth to understand the soul and the soil of a place. Obviously, there were role models for this magazine like Stack Magazine or Migrant Journal, but I think that Cartography as well is a really original project. And readers and bookshop owners, museum directors, contributors, and the environment of publishing around the world is really reacting so well. So the magazine is exploding, and I'm so happy about it because they are truly passionate. This couple is truly passionate. The fact that they exist and they do this kind of work is an inspiration for all those who practice in independent publishing and in publishing in general, because I think that we live in a world in which detox from digital is becoming essential and is becoming a paradise that is really at disposal.
That was Gianluigi Recuperati, and issue 3 of Cartography magazine is out now. That's it for this week's programme. Thanks to our producers, Fernando Augusto Pacheco and Henry Rhys Sheridan. Henry, thank you.
Thanks, Tom. I have been sitting here in silence for the duration of this episode. I mean,
I like it. I feel it shows the sort of deference and fealty that you feel towards me. Let's move on. Thanks to our editors, Cassie Galpin, Claire Urban, and George McDonough. If you have any comments or queries, feel free to drop a note to Fernando. He's on fp@monocle.com. And don't forget to join us at the same time next week. This is The Stack. My name's Tom Edwards. Thanks for tuning in.